This week on the Back Table Podcast.
One of our current residents came to me very spontaneously in one of these procedures that we had, trans radio, and he turned and said, "Oh my God, radio access is way better. It was way simpler." And I was like, wow, where that came from, right? And I wish I had recorded him because he was very spontaneous in saying that. So I think when you see today more experienced, more senior, more seasoned physicians having some reluctance, some resistance to adopt radio access, I understand that. But I think the younger population, the younger physicians, interventionalists are going to adopt more radio access as they see very clearly the benefits. And this young interventionalist that's going to be graduating now in July sees that benefit very clearly. And he has done a lot of cases transfemoral and transradio.
Welcome to the Back Table Podcast, your source for all things endovascular or otherwise minimally invasive. You can find all previous episodes of the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or backtable.com. First, a brief word from our sponsors.
Discover the Medtronic solutions for peripheral embolization. Concerto detachable coils are available in complex shape for framing and helical shape for filling. The MVP microvascular plug comes in sizes from 3 to 9, with 3 and 5 being microcatheter compatible. Learn more at www.medtronic.com/embolization.
Now, back to the episode.
This is Michael Barraza coming to you from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I'm joined by Dr. Marcelo Guimarães at Medical University of South Carolina. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. It's a privilege to be here, and thank you for having me to talk about radio interventions.
Yeah, we're going to talk about radial interventions, and we're going to hear about the RAVI registry. What I wanted to do first, a lot of our listeners are trainees and a lot of them are medical students. And I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about the program at MUSC, Medical University of South Carolina, which I know well. It's where I went to medical school. But for our med students and trainees listening, could you tell us a bit about it?
Absolutely. Michael, before we get started, I'd like to have some disclosures, if possible. I do have consulting work with Terumo Medical, with Medtronic, with Bailey's Medical. And also, I think it's important to share that I have worked with engineers from Terumo to develop the MG1, MG2 catheters that are long catheters for radio procedures. And I have no financial interest, no royalties or no payments related to that technology that was developed in collaboration with Terumo. Just want to make sure we get that
clear. You. I want to hear about those catheters later.
Sure.
All right. So tell me about MUSC.
So MUSC is, I'm biased because I've been working here for 16 years, and I think we have built over the years the best possible training program. We have currently independent and integrated programs in interventional radiology. We also accept people who were in the older fellowship track. We try to provide the best possible training with very diversified portfolio product of procedures. We perform basically almost every single procedure that interventional radiology performs today, except vascular, peripheral vascular disease, arterial disease. So we still do a lot of venous disease. We have a very strong collaboration with vascular surgery. So sometimes our residents that are interested in rotating with them, they rotate. And the same thing is true for vascular surgery residents rotating with us. Our residents who are interested in stroke, like I think you work with stroke, right? Some of our folks, depending on where they go to work, they need to cover stroke. So there's always a partnership with interventional neurology, neurointerventional folks, and our residents can rotate with them as well in order to get some training in stroke before they go to work. So I think it's a robust program. We have outpatient clinics. We just open up another OBL, where we do outpatient procedures. We have a rapid access clinic, and we also round in patients after we get them admitted, typically by hospitalists. We don't have infrastructure to admit our patients ourselves, but it's a pretty robust from the clinical perspective, from the diversification of cases, and from the involvement of the residents in research projects that we always have something going on.
Great. So MUSC was, an early adopter of radial access for interventions, and it's since become a well-known center for that. I mean, you guys are one of the hot places for radial interventions. You guys do it for all kinds of stuff. when and why did you really start that trend?
Michael, thank you. That's a great question. We started back in 2013. I was finishing a left SFA recanalization via right common femoral artery going up and over. The patient was obese, and after failure of a needle-assisted closure device, the patient developed a significant hematoma despite the fact that we held pressure for 1 hour and 15 minutes between myself and the resident. And at that day, I realized we have to do something different. This is not work, right? So I started to look for alternatives, and radio access was certainly one of them, but we didn't have devices. So we just, you know, went to the cardiologists and borrowed their catheters and their wires and sheaths and learned from them initially. And eventually we realized that we had something that was not something important, then not only useful for patients that were obese, like this first patient that maybe basically was the trigger, right, for us to start thinking about something else, but useful for many different type of procedures and for patients that are non-obese as well, especially patients that are with coagulation issues, for example. So today we have a list of benefits or patients that could benefit from radio, and basically, as you well said, became our default access. Especially in embolization therapy and interventional oncology therapy, basically there's no procedure today, maybe genicular artery in tall patients, that we cannot get to it. But all the other embolization procedures, from bronchial GI bleeding, trauma, splenic, radioembo, chemoembo, renal, pelvic trauma, or embolizations of aneurysms in the pelvis, for example, they all, UFC, PAE, all of them can be done radio access.
Yeah. So when you decided to start this, like, what was the process like? I found, you know, one of my biggest challenges when I go to a place that's not used to radio access is getting the room set up and getting the techs on board. What was that process like for you?
That's a very important question. If somebody, I'll tell you our story first. I think it's important for anybody who wants to start a program to really get involved and set the tone on how you would like to get a program, you know, how it gets to be built. So what I'm trying to say is we, in partnership with Terumo at that time, they offered to train our nurses and techs, especially the nurses in the prep recovery area, nurses on the floor, how they would recover these patients and remove the TR band that we use for compression at the end of the case, after the case. That was one part. The other one is I scrubbed myself and prepped the patients myself for the first, let's say, 15, 20 cases until we had all the techs, which is at that time we had about 12 people, until all the techs were, our Ts were aware how we wanted to get things done, and engaged in that process. So I think it's very important to set the tone and understand, they need to understand why we're doing what you're doing. So we gave lectures to our staff to give them the rationale behind why radio is important, what the advantages of radio, what are potential limitations of radio that at that time were primarily devices. And then we had the buy-in of our colleagues and staff. And after that, we started the program. So I think it's important to take the time, and I would discourage anybody from simply waking up one day and say, I'm going to do whatever procedure that I have on my schedule today, transradio, and everything will be fine. I think there will be frustration. There will be potential pushback from the staff, and that's not going to go well. So preparation, partner with the industry, and educate your staff and explain the why. I think there it will be easier to build up a successful program.
I think that's a good point in partnering with industry. And that is actually where I had the best success at two separate hospitals where I was the first person to do radial access for interventions. And, you know, I had shared my frustration. I did, one was with the Merit rep and one was with the Terumo rep. And, you know, I explained I was kind of frustrated with how this was going. And for each one, you know, the rep came, they, you know, they had the arm board for me, they educated the staff. And actually my Terumo rep actually like took the patient back after I did the TR band, like basically babysat the nurses and showed them how to take the balloon down and everything. And it made it much simpler. They know some of the ins and outs of educating the staff that we may look over. And I found that to be really beneficial.
I agree 100% with your comments. I think everybody should take advantage of that available resource and partner in order to have better outcomes.
Here's a question for you. You know, you're talking about starting a radial program. Say you're starting it from scratch at a hospital. What do you think is the basic equipment that you need?
I think it's more about the supplies, right? Because the equipment itself, you just need a good quality ultrasound to get started with. And I think that's one important aspect of radio access. Cardiology, I believe, in some centers still do cases without ultrasound guidance, just direct puncture, which is that's the way they were trained. That works for some of them. But I think I see a trend in cardiology and everywhere, I would say, in interventional radiology, to perform any vascular access or arterial venous in the body under ultrasound guidance in the last few years. So first of all, have a good ultrasound that you can use for puncture. In addition to that, different companies have different devices or to get access. So we use a dedicated slender sheath for radio access, which is very thin. I think you're familiar with that. It's a 4 or 5. I always like to call 4 or 5 French because it's outer diameter 4 French, roughly speaking, and then internal diameter is 5. So it has a short needle, not the standard longer micropuncture kit needle. So it's very user-friendly. I think you have experience with that. A good nitinol wire, and then we get access. So that's the first thing, is to have a good quality hydrophilic sheath and low profile. Second thing is to have a guide wire that does not go tangential from the left or right arm all the way down to the descending aorta. I would discourage anybody from using straight wire, for example, or a straight tip wire. Made better to use a very small J wire that you wouldn't avoid getting access to the small branches in the forearm, especially. We typically use the baby J, the baby because 1.5 millimeter small tip hydrophilic. And then catheters that are several available in the market. I mean, Boston Sci has, Merit has, Terumo has long catheters. And we use, and of course I'm biased here, that's where I think I started with a full disclosure. We have been using the MG1, MG2 catheter that we have developed. MG1 for the upper body, for celiac, SMA, and renals. And the MG2 has a little bit more open curve that can be used for IMA and for pelvis and for lower extremity as well. The MG2 can be used comes in 135, 150 length. And the MG1 upper body, 125. So the patient can be as tall as 6 feet and something else and additional inches, and the physician will have access without a problem.
That was going to be my next question, was length and height. You know, that used to be something that we had to think about. You know, it's like, I don't know if I can do this case radial because the patient's 6 feet. Now, you know, we've got much longer catheters designed for this. What's the shape look like of the MG1 and 2? You can just show me with your finger.
So the shape of the MG1 is like a Jackie or Sarah that Turum already had, but with a little different angulation in order to overcome the challenges that we have faced over the years with getting access to the descending aorta in patients with aortic arch type 3. So we did an extensive work with the engineers from Terumo to try to develop the best possible catheter and in a way to overcome those type 3 aortic arches. For type 1, type 2, no problem at all. It goes like very simple. So if you can show you with my hand here, the curve will be slightly like this way, right? Similar to this, with a slightly gentle curve at the very end to overcome that challenge in aortic arch type 3. The MG2 is a little bit more open curve, and then there's a slightly end, at the end, there's a slightly change in the curve in order to facilitate engagement into the uterine artery or prostatic artery or pelvic branches, and that's why it has 135, 150 in length. Some people actually have brought to my attention that they can use, instead of the 5 French, they can use a 4 French version of the MG2, 150, and just use that for UFEs without using a microcatheter whatsoever. I think that's an option, but I prefer to use the 135 with a 150 microcatheter and then go coaxially with a microcatheter, especially because of the tortuosity that some uterine arteries can have, as you know.
Oh, yeah, I'm with you. I like to use a microcatheter because I like to take it pretty far out there and then I could just embolize however I want. Yeah. So, you know, when I'm doing radial access for stroke interventions, it is primarily for the type 3 arch, and it just doesn't look like it's going to be doable from femoral. And so we use a 6 or 7 slender sheath and then form a Simmons 2 and then use that to access the right common carotid and go from there. And that has been like the biggest change in my practice for stroke is introducing radial. And it's been hard because, you know, it's a slightly bigger sheath, and getting the techs on board was a challenge too. But so now, you know, for most right-sided strokes, we'll just go ahead and prep the arm and the groin for each one. One thing that comes up with that, though, is, you know, we're in a hurry in those cases. You know, it's time is brain. And one of the challenges is doing, you know, the workup that you would normally do for radial access. So what I wanted to ask you, you know, what do you do before the case, you know, in evaluating the radial artery? Like, and when do you find yourself in a situation where you don't start radial?
Michael, that's a very important question. Thank you for that. I'd like to share with you our screening that we do, right? So at MUSC, and I have no data to support what I'm going to say, but this is the algorithm that we have developed over time and has worked for us in the last, we've been doing this since 2013, so it will be 11 years this year. And we had very good track record of not having stroke we've done thousands of cases since then. So first of all, I think it's important for anybody who wants to start a program to select an age for the population that you don't want to do radio access, or you need to have other criteria to fulfill in order to select patients for radio access, thinking in radio in safety reasons, right? For safety reasons. So for us, we picked the age of 70 years old. So if the patient has 70 years old and or older and does not have any chest CT available, then we tend to do femoral access. If the patient is younger than 70 years old, regardless of their having or not a chest CT, we're going to probably do radial access. But if the patient has a CT, for example, classic example that we see today, patient that comes for a Y90 infusion, radioembolization procedure for lung cancer, for example, for metastatic disease, primarily liver cancer, or let's say colorectal mets. During their staging, they're going to have already either a PET CT or they're going to have a chest CT. So we look at that information that is readily available. Of course, I will never order a chest CT just to check the radial, the safety around the aortic arch.
What are you looking for on that CT?
So I would look for the amount of calcifications in the vessel that gives access. So basically, Basically, what we do is we check the available PET CT or chest CT, look for calcifications in the aortic arch and in the vessel that we're getting access to, either right subclavian or right or denominate artery or left subclavian. And then we want to make sure that we minimize the risk of stroke. So if the patient can have, for example, 85 years old or 80 years old that comes for a GI bleeding and I see the aortic arch and it's clear or it has minimal calcifications, then we go and we perform radio access despite the age. So the age is important in case the patient does not have a chest CT. The second screening that we do is if the patient, we do with Barbeau test and we do ultrasound test in 100% of the cases. I hear some tendency from some different areas that are discouraging or not thinking that it's relevant to do Barbeau test or the ultrasound test, and I respect that. But what has worked well for us in the last basically 11 years doing radio access is to perform 100% of the cases ultrasound diameter to measure the AP diameter of the radio artery to make sure it's compatible with the diameter, outer diameter of the introducer sheath. And also we do the Barbeau test. It's a test that requires, as you know, it's a 15-20 seconds test. We already have the pulse oximeter that will be used for the procedure anyways, so there's no additional cost. We just need to have that hooked into the monitor and do a quick test. The patient can come to us for a trauma, for a GI bleeding, for an emergency situation. Does not matter. We always take the time to do that. If we start doing an elective case, we do that in clinic. Elective case of an inpatient, we do that on the floor. But if it's a trauma, we do that when the patient gets to the table just to make sure the patient's hand would be without any complication.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question was, you know, emergency cases. Because sometimes, you know, you'll get a trauma case and it's moving quickly. Occasionally, I'll find one where I just have to push through. So are you doing using the radial cocktail for everyone?
Thank you for the question. We use the radial cocktail. We do slightly different than what cardiology does. And to me, it doesn't really matter if you use a cocktail or not, as long as the physician uses a good amount of heparin throughout the case to prevent clot formation and use one or two types of vasodilators. What we have done over the years is we differentiate between oncology cases and non-oncology cases. When I say oncology, meaning basically liver-directed therapy, right? For those cases, we start always with 3,000 of heparin, and every 30 minutes after the case started, after the initial bolus, we give 1,000 of heparin.
Okay.
For non-oncology cases, for PAE, for let's say PAE, UFE, let's say splenic artery aneurysm, we're going to start with 5, or PAD, peripheral artery disease transradio, that we have done as well. We start with 5,000 of heparin, and then every 30 minutes, 1,000. Regarding the vasodilators, similarly, we divide in oncological cases or non-oncological cases. Oncological case, we use 200 micrograms of nitro at the beginning of the case and at the end of the case. For the other cases, PAE, UFE, large cases, any long case, any case that requires changing catheters, like from one side to another, for example, like in the pelvis, then we are going to use also verapamil 2.5, single dose at the beginning of the case. The reason why we do nitro at the end of the case is because we learned in a randomized prospective trial done in 2016 when we were doing angiograms of the forearm at the beginning of the case to look for like a roadmap to understand anatomy. Also, we did at the end of the case to understand more about what was happening at the end of the case. And we learned that in some situations, you can have a little bit of spasm at the end. That's why we use nitro at the end as well. And our track record, our outcomes have been very good and consistent after using this technique.
We hear a lot about spasm, and you know, you see some scary cases that people share where they can't get the sheath out at all. I have not come across one that bad. Have you had that happen where you just can't get anything out?
Yes, that's a great point to discuss. I had a case probably in 2014-15 when I was doing a long case. It was a left renal artery aneurysm. And I needed to use at the time a long 90 centimeters introducer sheath that was not hydrophilic. And after finishing the case, was probably 2 hours, 2 hours and a half case, the sheath got stuck. And I tried to increase the level of sedation. I tried to increase, it was a moderate sedation case, it was not a general anesthesia. I tried to pull very gently with a continuous tension, but to try to pull back, and patient was having significant discomfort. So at that time, I was either going to call vascular surgery to do a cut down and remove that, or I thought, well, why not to simply get access transfemoral? I advanced the vert catheter into the ostium of the left subclavian. I was doing a left radio access. And then we put applied the TR band on the patient's wrist, and I said to our fellow, I'm going to inject the nitro. Let's pull the sheath right away, try to pull right away, and then let's inflate the TR band because we're going to have hemostasis. And that's exactly what we did, and worked extremely well, just giving one dose of nitro. I did not use sheaths, just a 5-French catheter all the way up to the the subclavian. And we were able to inject nitro, and was enough to release the spasm. And that's what I would do again.
That's a great idea. I think that's what I would try if and when it happens to me at some point. That's a really good solution.
It is important to be told, Michael, as you know, because you have experience on radio. This is very rare, right? This is very rare, especially if you manipulate the artery carefully. You don't turn the catheter too fast. You have a slow manipulation of the catheter, gentle. It's very rare to have spasm. Other things that I'd like to mention that some people have used over time, and I'm not sure if that's necessarily helpful, but I think it's important just to mention, is to inject nitro along the artery, along the track of the radial artery. In this case, probably would not be useful because I had a 90 centimeters, right? And the catheter... The introducer sheath tip was in the left renal artery, so it would be useless. But that's something that people have reported. Other thing is to use the blood pressure cuff in the upper arm, and then inflate that about 10, 20 millimeters of mercury above the systolic pressure with the intention, with the expectation to create some post-deflation of the cuff vasospasm in the forearm. And that has been reported to work as well. Because I only had that case and that's the way I fixed, I don't have experience with the other techniques.
Yeah. So you mentioned the long introducer sheath that you had. When you're doing radial access for abdominal and pelvic interventions, are you using a short sheath or are you using something long that goes down into the aorta?
Basically, that's a great question as well. I only use the short introducer sheath, the slender short. Some people prefer to use long access in some specific situations. I definitely would consider using a long introducer sheath if I need support or if I need control arteriogram during the case. For example, if I'm going to perform a SMA stenting, celiac stenting, that I need to have that for support and for control angiogram throughout the case, I'm definitely going to use a slender 119 centimeters, for example, that gives me access easily to the descending aorta. That's one example, right? But generally speaking, for embolotherapy, which is the most common thing we do with transradial, I don't recall requiring a long introducer sheath in order to perform the procedures. Would
me
you
either.
Agree with that?
No, absolutely. To be honest, I don't know that I've ever used a long sheath from radial. You mentioned in the last case you shared that it was from left radial access. When are you accessing the left instead of the right?
Well, our standard, or let's say that we started our journey using radial access with the left side. And we did that for many, many, many years until, let's say, 2 years ago when one of our former residents, now partner, suggested, well, we don't do right radio access. And I thought it was a great idea. And I said, well, we don't do radio on the right because of the risk of potential risk of stroke. We don't want to cross the supraaortic vessels. The length of the catheters are, you lose basically 10 centimeters, right? Between the distance of the right and left subclavian arteries to the descending aorta, you basically lose about 10 centimeters, 4 inches in length. But the reality is, if you review the literature, the cardiology literature that is available, there's at least one paper out there that I recall well describing basically no difference. Of course, coronary interventions, not peripheral interventions or visceral embolizations, but no difference in stroke if you get access on the right or if you get access on the left. And that's why, and the other thing that the reason why we started to consider the right side is also because we had some feedback from our RTs saying, you know what, during the Y90 or radio embolization workup, when we need to do the spin, and we always use the left arm open 90 degrees or 45 degrees away from the arm, you needed to tuck the arm against the torso, wrap up the patient's body, put some sort of a gutter, right, to arm board to secure the arm so we have space enough to do the spin. And what we learned is that that was not a very pleasant experience for some of the techs. Some techs didn't care, but some others, that was a problem. So we decided to use basically the right arm, and that's what we've been doing more recently now, for all sorts of embolization therapy, is the right arm tucked against the torso with the left arm behind the patient's head so we have more space for a spin. And that has helped a lot because there's no movement. And we work movement of the arm, number one. Number two, you work, as you know, Michael, you are facing the screen working from like a right common femoral artery approach. The artery is right there, super simple. And I wonder, how do you do? Can you share with me?
So I do left radial access for abdominal and pelvic interventions. But now that I think about it, I'm thinking about how I'm craning my neck a lot of the time and struggling to get everything where I want it. And when I look at it in comparison, you know, when I'm doing strokes from radial access, it's usually the right. And it is a more comfortable experience for me. And so I think I need to try that, you know, to try to do a spin from right radial access and see how that works. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, we have done, I mean, many, many, many cases the last 2 years. We actually want to do a review on that and publish about it, because I think people need to know that it is safe. as long as you follow the same criteria, right? So we screen about age, about aortic arch calcifications, about the size in of the radial artery, in the ultrasound exam, all those things definitely can add value and safety to the procedure.
You mentioned comfort for, you know, the doctor, and I think it's also consideration for the patient. What do you think the patient experience is like for, you know, radial access compared to femoral?
It's a great question. I actually have very specific data to share with you. We did a randomized trial back in 2015-16 comparing trans patients who came for liver-directed therapy, was bland embo or chemoembolization, not radio embo at that time. And we, most of those patients, as you know, they needed 2 to 4 procedures every 30 days apart. And we randomized the patients to have radio first, and then the second procedure was automatically, for example, femoral. Or if the patient was randomized to femoral first, the second procedure was automatically radio, okay? So all patients, they had at least 2 procedures. They had both experiences. And then the third procedure, if necessary, or if it was not necessary, we asked them, they picked the one they wanted according to the randomization that they had before. So that was a very interesting design of the study because we had some intra and inter-patient control, right? So doing that, I'll tell you that the vast majority, and that has been reported, published, replicates our finding, about 75 to 85% of patients prefer radio access. So in our study, out of 5 patients, 4 prefer radio access. So that's a fact. And we heard many different comments that we collected at that time. And one of the comments was, for example, was easier to get back to my normal life. I didn't have much discomfort in my wrist versus my groin. I was able to bow forward, to sit up, and to kind of find a better comfortable position, especially after UFE. If you compare to the femoral access when I need to keep my legs straight, I had access to the restroom right after. I was better for my back pain, right? People didn't need to be straight in bed for additional hours. Think about it. Patients have, and they are in bed for hours, 1 hour, 2 before the procedure time, plus after procedure. We're talking about 5 hours, 6 hours laying in a flat position, right? So we had many reasons why we collected data at that time, why people prefer radio versus femoral.
So while we're on the topic of the data, I mean, what does the data tell us about radial access in terms of safety and efficacy?
It is great to share with you, Michael, that the data to support radio access for interventional oncology, interventional radiology procedures like embolotherapy, it became very robust in the last 10 years, which is very different than if you had the same question back in 2013, right? So let's start a little bit with cardiology. With cardiology today, both the American Society and the European Society recommend in their society guidelines that radio access should be the number one access, preferred access in percutaneous coronary interventions. I hope that as we learn more about the benefits of radio, our society will also embrace radio to that level. And the data has been showing now that if you compare many studies, radio versus femoral, radio is as safe as femoral. There's no higher incidence of, for example, of bleeding or hand ischemia or stroke. Also has been effective in many different scenarios, in trauma, in splenic embo, in UFE, PAE, liver-directed therapy. I mean, has been extensively studied in multiple different procedures. If you see a systematic review of more than 1,000 patients that was published years ago, again, every 5 patients, 4 preferred radio access, and there's no significant difference in the majority of the variables, such as fluoroscopy time or complications. One thing I'll tell you, that cost is one of them that can be in favor of radio. Because if in your practice, you typically use a closure device, that's going to be more expensive than to use a TR band or any other band that you want to use for compression. Of course, if you don't use closure device, you just hold pressure in the femoral, common femoral artery, then it's going to be probably, the rate is going to be slightly more expensive. But if you use closure like we do all the time, actually there's a cost benefit in doing radio as well. So as we talk about data, I'd like to mention to you, if it's okay, our RAVI registry data. And this is something that I'm very proud of sharing with you. We're very grateful to all the co-authors of this paper that were operators in radio interventional procedures. This is up to now, the largest prospective registry study on radio embolizations in visceral interventions done via left radio artery. We had colleagues from Mount Sinai, from UNC, from St. Louis, from Rush University, and for UCLA. And I'm very proud to share with you that we were able to enroll 99 patients. And out of those, we had basically 0% of stroke, 0% of hand ischemia, 0% of conversion from radio to femoral, 0% of adverse events related to the access, and 0% of clinically evident radio artery occlusion. So this is a meaningful study, I believe. Of course, I'm totally biased on that, but this shows a multicentric study showing strong evidence that radio access is safe if done following the steps that we have published years ago as standards of practice at the JVIR, Standards of Practice of the Society of Intervention Radiology paper in 2022 that we published, in which we just tried to describe there our experience and the other co-authors' experience on things like we discussed before. Things like doing screening with Barbeau test, the ultrasound diameter measurement, make sure the patient has a lot of calcifications or not, make sure that we use drugs to prevent spasm and radio artery thrombosis, use some sort of device to have the patent hemostasis at the end, which is associated, as you know, with radio artery patency if you use a closure device and use the patent hemostasis concept versus simply holding pressure at the end of the case. So if people follow what we came up with in the past, the seven pillars of radio access, this is going to result in better outcomes and better patient care.
That's fantastic. In the registry, what cases primarily were you guys doing?
The majority of the cases were uterine fibroid embolization, and we had some cases of renal embolization, and some cases of liver-directed therapy, PAE cases, but the majority were UFE.
I think one of the most important points that you shared from this, considering, you know, the variety of cases that were included, is that there's a 0% conversion rate. And I think that shows how far we've come in terms of, you know, our ability to navigate these cases, but also the equipment that we use, you know, not having to switch to femoral.
Yes. And I think it's all about those two aspects. One is adequate devices that are dedicated to radio. Number two is it's follow a protocol screening and a protocol during the procedure that is safe, I think that's an important point, Michael, because what we learn is that if you have the right tools, the right devices dedicated to radio, and if the physician uses the adequate protocol following the best practices, I think the patients will benefit from it and the physician can build a successful program.
So I'm curious if in the trial, if there was a standardized series of steps in order to maintain the patency, or does every place do their own thing? You know, you had shared that MUSC has a slightly different protocol in terms of giving medications to, you know, to keep the access open. Does everybody do something different in the trial, or did you all follow the same steps?
Excellent question. In the trial, because it is a registry, as you know, registry has to be, it's not a rigid protocol like a randomized clinical trial would be requiring. So we try to provide with this study a real world data, right? So everybody followed the basic principles to give antispasmodic, so vasodilation, given heparin, but the dose, the interval, one drug or two, that was up to the physician's discretion. The devices, they were all radio access dedicated, but they were also at to the physician's discretion because there were different, you know, little variations between the hospital to hospital. But overall, the entire group follows the basic concepts for safety reasons, and that's why we were able to obtain such great outcomes as we did.
That's fantastic. One other question I wanted to ask you is, are there any particular challenges that you come across in radial interventions? I know we've covered some, you know, with spasm, patients with a lot of calcification. You know, one that I can think of that I've been fortunate to not have come up very often is the radial loop.
Yeah, I had two. That's a good point. I had two cases in my experience in the last doing radio access in the last 11 years when the patients had radial loop. And I'll tell you that if you use the correct wire, the adequate wire, which is for us, it works well to use the hydrophilic Baby J 1.5 millimeter radial, as we discussed before. That wire has the tip floppy enough to go through tortuosities. And the rest of the wire has body enough to actually straight up that loop and at the same time give you access down to the descending aorta with your diagnostic catheter. So all the two loops that I had, both, we were able to straight up performing just with the combination. Again, for the two cases, the two loops that we had, we were able to straight up with the Baby J and MG1, MG2 catheters, and the patient had no issues at all.
That's great. You mentioned you use the TR band for hemostasis. Would you mind sharing your protocol for, you know, after the band is up, what happens next?
So regardless, we use the TR band, but the physicians can use whatever compression device they prefer, right? We use that because we believe that's the one that has worked for us. With that in mind, our protocol is we follow the guidelines of the TR band. So basically in the first hour, we don't touch the band. And then within the last second hour, every 15 minutes, a quarter of the volume that is inside the band, insufflated in the band, is removed from the band. So for example, let's say we left 12 cc's of air inside the band. Every 15 minutes, we're going to aspirate 3 cc's with the intention that at the end of the second hour, the band will be totally deflated. Typically, we leave the patient under observation a little bit. They are changing their clothes. Everything is okay. And about 10, 15 minutes later, everything looks good. They can go home. We have changed that. And actually, we're going to present at the SIR, a recent study in which we used a TR band instead of for 2 hours in total. We think that we can obtain hemostasis safely with 1 hour. And our data showed no difference in thrombosis or in hematoma or in bleeding if you use a 2 hours protocol or I like to call the fast track protocol, if you will, right? So the fast track was very simple. And let's think a little bit about the thought process, the basics of this study. Every time we do a femoral approach, the femoral artery has about 5 to 6 millimeters. Would you agree? The common femoral artery. And typically, unless if you use a lot of heparin, typically we hold pressure for about 15 minutes. So why to hold pressure in an artery that is half of the size for 1 hour? Unless if you use a lot of heparin, then I get it. But if not, it's not needed. So what we have changed a little bit of that protocol is to hold pressure or keep the balloon inflated without touching it for 15 minutes. And then along the next 30 minutes, we deflated the balloon. And then in the last 15 minutes, we observed, with the intention that within 1 hour, the patient can go home. And what we also have been using is to use some sort of a splint right on the patient's forearm and around the patient's wrist to prevent bending, moving too much the patient's hand. That has helped the patients to have good outcomes. So that's what we have been doing.
That brings up one thing I forgot to ask you that I'd meant to. Where do you prefer to access the radial artery?
Typically, I like to palpate the styloid process and then 1 or 2 centimeters more proximally towards the patient's elbow, that's where I stick. And as you know well, Michael, sometimes the radial artery can bifurcate distally just before the wrist. So I follow the basic concepts, measure the diameter. If I have, for example, bifurcation right there and one of them is bigger, for us, works to have AP diameter bigger than 1.6, equal or bigger than 1.6 millimeters. That's the magic number we've been using to support a 4-5 introducer sheath, the slender introducer sheath. And then if the patient has that diameter, we go and stick one of the two. If there's a single artery, we follow the same basic principle, 1 or 2 centimeters approximately from the styloid process. What about you? What do you do?
So I've just looked, I like to see where it starts to come close to the surface. I don't go to the styloid process. I mean, I'm right at the wrist, but basically I look at it like I look at a common femoral artery. When I'm accessing a common femoral, you know, after I've marked my spot, find the bifurcation, I like to find that spot where it comes closest to the skin. And that's generally what I do with the radial, as long as it's large enough. I've been using 2 millimeters as a cutoff, but it's nice to know 1.6 is the magic number. I guess I hadn't changed from 2 since the introduction of the slender sheets.
Yeah. I mean, again, Michael, this is just one way to do it. I don't want to pass the message here that this is the best way or the only way to do, by no means. But that has worked well for us in the last 11 years doing radio access.
Well, you certainly have plenty of experience, and you know, I'm thrilled to get to see the results of the studies, and hopefully we'll get to hear what you have to say at SIR. Is there anything else about radial access, or really anything else that you'd like to cover that I didn't go over?
First of all, Michael, thank you for the opportunity to share our experience on radio access. I think that it's important to emphasize the benefits of radio, right? So just to repeat a little bit of things that we covered and some things that we did not cover. Radio access, in our opinion, humble opinion, should be today, with the evidence we have, considered as it is to for us the default access for any embolization therapy that we perform. I'll give you a concrete example here. One of our current residents, his name is Max Strobel. And Max came to me very spontaneously in one of these procedures that we had, transradio. And he turned and said, "Oh my God, radio access is way better. It was way simpler." And I was like, wow, where that came from, right? And I wish I had recorded him, because he was very spontaneous in saying that. So I think when you see today more experienced, more senior, more seasoned physicians having some reluctance, some resistance to adopt to radio access, I understand that. But I think the younger population, the younger physicians, interventionalists, are going to adopt more radio access as they see very clearly the benefits. And this young interventionalist that's going to be graduating now in July sees that benefit very clearly. And he has done a lot of cases transfemoral and transradio. So other benefits that I'd like to highlight are in coagulopathic patients. We don't stop anymore aspirin, Plavix, anticoagulation. Number one, we don't stop. If there's a risk of cardiac or stroke event, we do not run that risk anymore doing transradio. If the patient has, for example, low platelets, as low as 7,000, or INR as high as 4.2, as long as the order parameter is within the normal limits, let's say INR of 4.2, but platelets are above 50,000, or platelets at 7,000, but INR is below 1.5, we've been doing radio access without a problem, without any bleeding complications. And if the patient bleeds in the future, in any scenario, we'll be bleeding after the case when you have the TR band, and then you have all the time in the world to transfuse FFP, platelets, whatever needs to be fixed, and you don't delay patient care, and you do not spend money or time giving blood products that you don't need to. I would say that radio access should be considered for any patient regardless of their weight. And definitely, there's a faster recovery. Patients prefer that. So I would say that if anybody wants to build up a successful program, first of all, take the time to educate your staff. Partner with the industry. I think there are several companies out there that are willing to partner with and to support. And the goal that we have is to build up a meaningful program in a way that, because the more cases you do, Michael, the more experience you'll have and the more comfortable you are going to be. Some people think about, okay, I'm going to use radio just in exceptional cases. Whenever I feel like it's super important, you're not going to build up the necessary expertise to feel very comfortable. That's why today became our default access. So I think I'll leave you with that.
Thank you. I appreciate your time and for sharing your expertise with us, and hopefully we can get you back on here for something else.
Sounds great. Michael, it was great talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Anne Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Sudley.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.